WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to Community Watch and Comment for Tuesday, November 11th. I'm Dave Rabin. On today's show, Boston University history professor Dr. William Keeler discusses how the British and French carved up the Middle East after World War I and its effect on the region today. Theater J artistic director Ari Roth and his company's upcoming production, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism, with the key to the scriptures. Is that a mouthful or what? That's not part of the title. And after that, Center for Economic Policy and Research, Eileen Applebaum, co-author of Private Equity at Work, When Wall Street Manages Main Street, and the Harmonious Wales, Sims Delaney Potthoff and his Gypsy Swing Band's upcoming performance at the Corner Store on Capitol Hill. Don't go away. And we're back with you here on Community Watch and Comment. I'm Dave Rabin. Today is Armistice Day, renamed Veterans Day in the United States and Remembrance Day in Great Britain. The holiday was established to honor the date in 1918 when Germany and the Allies signed an armistice agreement to end hostilities in World War I. But Germany wasn't the only defeated foe. The Ottoman Empire also fell, and the British and French carved up the Middle East in a manner that still reverberates today. And joining us to talk about Veterans Day and World War I's impact on the current Middle East is Dr. William Keeler, professor of history at Boston University. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's great to actually hear your voice. We've been communicating by email, and we finally get to speak. I appreciate your time.
We do indeed. Let me just add that I am a professor at the Pardee School of Boston University.
That's the Pardee School at Boston University.
P-A-R-D-E-E, yes.
P-A-R-D-E-E.
Right.
Right. The World War I armistice took effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, and it's 11 o'clock right now, so we're kind of honoring the end of the war at just the right moment. Talk about Veterans Day and its significance.
Right. Well, Veterans Day, of course, harks all the way back to the end of World War I. I suppose that most Americans today don't realize that November 11th is the date of the armistice. They think of it as a Veterans Day celebrating all veterans, which it has become. But it was originally intended to take note of the veterans that had fought in the Great War.
Right, right. And we sort of have morphed it into honoring all veterans, but it was originally meant to be particular to acknowledge not just veterans, but the war dead from World War I.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's how it's treated, I believe, in Europe and elsewhere to this day. So at the end of the war, there's a famous treaty created between 1918 and 1919 in Versailles. If you could just touch briefly on that, who were the entities involved in that treaty?
Yes, well, the peace conference at the end of World War I was held in Paris And in the course of the negotiations of that peace conference, the victors signed five separate treaties with the five countries that had been defeated in the war, and the Treaty of Versailles is the peace treaty with Germany. It was signed in the Palace of Versailles outside of Paris, in the Hall of Mirrors of the palace, which was precisely the same place where the German Empire was declared back in 1871 after the Franco-Prussian War. So it had tremendous symbolic significance, particularly for the French. The Treaty of Versailles dealt only with Germany, but as I say, there were four other powers, or former powers, I should say, that were defeated and had to sign the peace treaty that was submitted to them.
Mm-hmm. And before we get to that treaty, during the war, there are three promises, if you will, made by the British and the French. I believe, just chronologically, the first was the McMahon-Hussein correspondence.
Yes.
If you could talk about that.
Sure. That was the result of negotiations carried on in 1915 and 1916 between the British High Commissioner in Egypt. You remember that Britain controlled Egypt at that time, Sir Henry McMahon, and Sharif Hussein, who was the emir, he called himself a king, but he wasn't really, of the western part of the Arabian Peninsula. There's no Saudi Arabia yet. The western part of this of the Arabian Peninsula, known as the Hejaz, and he was important because under his jurisdiction were the two most important and revered holy sites of Islam, Mecca and Medina. So essentially what happened as a result of those negotiations was that the Arab peoples were brought into a war against Turkey, against the Ottoman Empire. So the British, in exchange for getting this pledge that the Arabs under his control would rise up and pin down the Turkish soldiers there, that Great Britain pledged that it, after the war was over, it would support the creation of an Arab state south of Turkey proper. They didn't know exactly where that state was going to be, and there were some maps that they exchanged, but that was it.
Mm-hmm. And this is the era of T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, right?
That's right. He was a kind of a liaison officer, and he got to know not only Sharif Hussein, but particularly his son Faisal. Lawrence actually accompanied the Arab troops as they are fighting the Turks. He's, by the way, his role in all of this has been grossly exaggerated. He had the good fortune to have a PR man who was an American journalist named Lowell Thomas, who did a tour of the United States after the war and sort of popularized Lawrence's role far out of proportion to what it was. And of course that led eventually to the famous film by David Lean, Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm-hmm. But he was important enough that the King of England intended to knight him, right?
Well, yes, that's true, although he was a very controversial figure. There are some folks that strongly disliked him, others who revered him. So he wasn't the white knight that he is portrayed, particularly in the film.
Right. Surprise, surprise, Hollywood tended to glamorize
Indeed.
Things. Yes, shocking.
So that's the first.
So that's the first, and so we're talking about independence for at least part of the Arabian Peninsula and south of Turkey. So that's a lot of territory. We're talking about what is now Syria, Lebanon, Iraq,
right? That's right.
Yeah, I mean, and that was going to be, at least under that agreement, that McMahon-Hussein correspondence, that was going to be one country?
It was left a little vague. During war, you don't want to be precise, and the British just wanted to get those Arabs in revolt against the Turks, so they were very vague about where that country would be, and this is one of the major problems that we have faced ever since.
Right, but the Arabs are relying on that in their fight for independence against the Turks.
That's right, and when the peace conference opens, one of the sons of Sharif Hussein, Prince Faisal, appears at the peace conference with Lawrence as his advisor and interpreter, and Faisal makes a very strong plea for the recognition of an Arab state. At the peace conference.
But what Faisal doesn't know, and what Lawrence doesn't know, I believe, is that there was a secret agreement made in 1916, if you could talk about that.
That's right. This was a so-called Sykes-Picot Agreement, and it was negotiated between British and French diplomats.
And, of course, the British and the French are allies in the war against Germany and its allies.
That's right. Exactly. This is before the United States intervenes in the war.
Right.
But the British and French governments authorized these two negotiators, Mark Sykes and Georges Picot, to reach an agreement that would effectively partition the area south of what we know of as Turkey today, that is the Arabic-speaking people south of Turkey, into British and French spheres of influence. And again, it was left vague what that exactly meant, but it clearly indicated that these two European powers were intent on making sure that the Turks lose that territory and that they become the dominant powers there.
And as you said, the United States is not yet in the war, and I'm assuming that the United States, President Wilson, don't know about this agreement.
Don't know about it. The agreement is finally published, ironically enough, by the Russians, because after the Bolshevik Revolution, Lenin and his associates get to look at all of the correspondence that was carried on with the Allies, and the Tsar had been carbon copied on this by the British and the French, and so there it was in the Soviet or the Russian archives, and so the new Bolshevik government publishes the Sykes-Picot Agreement for the world to see. It was something of an embarrassment for the British.
So, and they do that before Versailles?
Yes, this is after the Bolshevik Revolution in November of 1917. A couple of days afterwards, they publish all of the so-called secret treaties that the Allies had signed during the war, and this was one of them.
So Lawrence is actually at Versailles, right?
Yes, Lawrence
of Arabia and
yep.
Faisal are at, so they know about it by that point.
But they do indeed.
Okay.
And Lawrence is trying to overcome that get the British and French to abolish that.
And this is counter to the ideology of the President Wilson of the United States, who are believers, supporters of self-determination, right?
Indeed. Two major points that Wilson makes that are violated by this agreement are, number one, as you say, the principle of national self-determination, that people have a right to control their own territory and choose their own leaders and so forth, but it was also a violation of another one of Wilson's famous 14 points, that is, open covenants of peace openly arrived at, and that was directed at the so-called secret treaties. If you're going to make a treaty, it's got to be negotiated above board, and everybody's got to know about it. So it's a violation of two Wilsonian principles.
Right. And then we have a third agreement that occurs, or understanding, if you will, that occurs before the end of the war, and that's the Balfour Declaration, yeah. If you could talk about that.
Sure. The Balfour Declaration issued November 2nd, 1917, commits the British government to the to support the establishment of what was called a Jewish home in Palestine. Nobody quite knows what the word home means, and nobody quite knows where Palestine exactly is, but the purpose of the Balfour Declaration was to win the support of Jews, particularly in Eastern Europe, and particularly in the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the German Empire. There were a number of Jewish citizens of those two enemy countries, and the hope was that by issuing this, that it would win the support of Jewish people in the Central Powers. That was at least one of the purposes of the Declaration. All of the countries involved in this war were engaged in what we call political warfare, that is, promoting unrest behind the lines of the enemy. The Germans are supporting the Irish nationalist movement. The French are very active in supporting the Czechoslovak and Polish national movement. In other words, everybody's trying to undermine the security of the enemy by stirring up people behind the lines.
Right, and they're also behind the lines attacking. I mean, there were even attacks on the United States by the Germans just across the river from New York City, I think.
That's right.
I mean, just it's fascinating history.
Yep.
But the Balfour Declaration specifically says that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities
right.
in Palestine.
That's right. Approximately 90% of the people in Palestine at the time were, of course, not Jewish. And so they wanted to make sure that this establishment of a Jewish home would not encroach on the interests of the non-Jewish population there. It's also a sentence in the Balfour Declaration which says that nothing in this declaration would in any way adversely affect the rights of Jews in other countries. And that was put there because there was some opposition to the Zionist program in Great Britain. There were some British Jews who had assimilated and were worried that if you create a Jewish home there, that would undermine their sense of security in Britain.
Hmm. So with this depth of historical understanding, what's your view of what's going on in the Middle East today? For example, if the allies of the British and the French and perhaps the United States had been more quote-unquote enlightened, or at least the British and the French, how might that have changed what we're seeing in Iraq today? Would the lines, would the international boundaries be different? Would the Sunni not have to deal with the Shia in Iraq, for example?
Yeah, that's a really, really difficult question. This is counterfactual history. Assuming that you honored Wilson's
yes.
principle of national self-determination and you held a plebiscite in this area and asked the people what kind of government would you have and so forth, as I say, that would have a very unfortunate and negative effect on the Balfour Declaration, because the people that lived there at the time were predominantly Arab. The term Palestinian didn't exist then. What's called the Arabs in Palestine, and that certainly would have precluded the establishment of a Jewish state later on. The question is, what would have been the implications or the consequences of that for the rest of the Middle East. And I think there's a big question mark there, because the people that made the agreement with the British were not from the region. They were from the western part of the Arabian Peninsula. And what happens is that two of the sons of Sharif Hussein are taken by the British, are plucked away from the Hejaz, which is the western part of the Arabian Peninsula, and are put on the throne of Iraq, formerly Mesopotamia, renamed Iraq, and Jordan. They were not from the area, and in the case of Iraq, the fact that they were Sunni Muslim did not go over well with the majority of people in Iraq, which were then and now Shiite, and so there is a Shiite rebellion in 1920 against this. So I guess what I'm saying is that if the people had been allowed to choose the kind of government that they wanted, it would have completely transformed the Middle East in a way that we would not even recognize.
Right. I mean, before World War One, you don't even have countries named Iraq and Jordan.
No, absolutely. No, these are all...
These are all creations of post-World War One by the British and the French.
That's right. They were part of the Ottoman Empire, and they had their own sort of local identity, but they certainly did not have a sense of statehood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about Lebanon? The French install a Christian government in Lebanon?
Well, the French are going to obtain a mandate under the League of Nations. That is, that Wilson did not like the idea of increasing colonial control, so they don't want to call that a colony. They want to call it a mandate, a trust territory under the League of Nations. And the French get Lebanon and also Syria. So France is going to rule those two countries directly, unlike the situation of the British in Jordan, or Transjordan, as it was then called, and Iraq. The British are going to put these two Arab leaders on the throne in Baghdad and Amman, and of course the British are completely in control there. The French just administer both Lebanon and Syria directly. There isn't going to be an Arab government in either one of those countries until the end of World War II. So in that sense, the French are not allowing the Arab peoples in their two mandates, even the sort of, probably you'd have to say, the fig leaf of self-determination that the British gave to the Jordanians and the Iraqis.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, the Kurds. The Kurds had been promised a lot during the war, but didn't bear fruit.
Yeah, here I will mention a personal experience I had. I was doing research in the Ministry of War in Vincennes, just outside of Paris, and I came across this huge carton. And I opened it, and there was a big stack of petitions from Kurdish representatives at the peace conference, pleading with the peacemakers, with the diplomats, to accord them self-determination. They knew what language to use there, because Wilson was right there. And in fact, the peace conference did, at least theoretically, agree that the Kurds should have an independent state of Kurdistan. The problem with that is that when the Treaty of Sèvres, which was the treaty that they negotiated with Turkey, led to an outbreak of Turkish nationalism because of all the territory that had been lost, and so when Kemal Atatürk takes control there, it's going to basically abolish the Treaty of Sèvres. So the Kurds never get the state that they were promised. The other problem the Kurds have very quickly is that they don't just simply exist within Turkey, but there are also Kurdish populations, as we know today, in Syria and Iraq, and also a little slice of Iran as well. So the Kurds are cursed because they have these other powers that are going to cooperate to prevent them from getting their national self-determination.
Lots of betrayals going on here. And,
indeed.
And just lastly, I mean, this is all of interest to the British and the French, because we're talking oil here. I mean, I think we're in the 20th century now, and before that, the war machines were not running on oil, but by World War One they were.
That's right, exactly. The British switch over from coal to oil in their navy just before the war, and at the end of the war, Britain is desperate to get oil because there isn't a lot of oil in the empire. And so they're going to take control of Iraq, and they're going to dominate the oil resources of Iraq. They also make a deal with the French that they'll provide the French with certain supplies of oil. But the British want to make sure that they control that oil area.
Right. We unfortunately are going to have to end it there. Could go on. It's incredibly interesting, and I think important to have this context. I've been speaking with Dr. William Keeler. He's professor of history at the Pardee School at Boston University. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
Excellent. I really appreciate your time spending with us. So thanks so much.
Nice speaking with you.
Great. Take care. And coming up, a new production at Theater J. Don't go away. And we're back with you here on Community Watch and Comment. I'm Dave Rabin. DC Theater J is opening a new show this week, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with the Key to the Scriptures. And joining us to talk about the production is Theater J's artistic director, Ari Roth. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, David.
It's got to be the longest name for a play that I can remember. Can you think of anything longer than that?
14 words, but no verb. No verb appears.
I hadn't thought about that.
It could be longer. It could be longer. It's a mashup of two titles, the founder of Christian Science and George Bernard Shaw, spinning on both to create a play that is just full of incredible debate, argumentation within the context of, you know, telling a great family story.
Tell us about the playwright.
Well, Tony Kushner is the playwright who brought us Angels in America 25 years ago, and 10 years after that, Homebody Kabul, and 3 years after that, Caroline or Change. And then he's brought us a stream of films, from the HBO version of Angels in America to his first collaboration with Steven Spielberg, Munich, to, of course, his Academy Award nomination for Lincoln, which took him 7 years to complete as a screenwriter, with many more film projects on the way. And so the fact that we have a new play by Tony Kushner, one that he's continued to work on, since it started at the Guthrie Theater and then went to the public in 2011, he's really wrestled this beast to hone it so tightly and so profoundly. It's really his most mature work to date, and intergenerationally it's so rich. And as he shared with readers of the Washington Post over the weekend, you know, he didn't realize that he was writing about his own family. In writing about Italian Americans living in Brooklyn, a longshoreman who was a union organizer who was looking back on his life and the wreckage of left-wing politics that it is in 2007, at the tail end of the Bush administration. It's a man who looks despondently on what's happened to left-wing politics and what the hell we're going to do about it, what he's going to do about it with the rest of his life. So it's a very profound meditation and a really tough family play.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose it? Just for all of the above?
All of the above. Family, labor, the future of progressive politics, and great, great entertainment. He looks at the basic issues of life and death and what makes life worth living when there's so much disappointment all around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what can you say? I mean, you know, we're living in a moment where if you believe in a progressive vision, you're feeling depressed, you're feeling demoralized, you wonder how on earth we're going to get out of this web that constrains and constricts us, and the environment is something we're laying waste to, and you need a great thinker, a great writer, to wrestle through all of this with you in the most human of terms.
So given what you're saying about the play, you probably were quite pleased with the results of the midterm elections, because it sets the...
Well, you know, we get braced, you know, every 4 years in a different alternating cycle. There's fresh reasons to be totally depressed about the future of the country and how that, you know, how that demoralization knocks, you know, as people in the solar plexus, and sort of you stop working as hard, you stop fighting as hard, you stop believing that change is possible, and you need to get re-energized. You need to get a swift kick in the butt and start working and digging and really questioning yourself again. And that's what this play is full of, deep questions to the self. It's not about attacking Ronald Reagan or George Bush. It's about saying, what do we really believe in? What are we really going to fight for?
Mm-hmm. So if you want a kick in the butt, check this play out at Theater J. Where can information?
We've got really important Pay What You Can previews. This Thursday night is our very first public performance of this D.C. premiere, 7:30 at 16th and Q Street. The box office opens up 90 minutes before showtime. Same with Monday night, the 17th, before we open for the critics. There's low-cost previews over the weekend as well. And the show's going to run through December 21st.
Mm-hmm. And your website?
www.theaterj.org, and it's theater with an E-R and the letter J.
Wonderful. I want to thank you for your time and for your work. I've been speaking with Theater J Artistic Director Ari Roth. Thank you so much.
You bet, David. Thank
you. Take care. And coming up, a look at private equity. Don't be scared. We're gonna put it out in lay terms. Don't go away. With you here on Community Watch and Comment. I'm Dave Rabin. Since 2000, nearly 11,500 companies representing almost 8 million employees have been purchased by private equity firms. This is Mitt Romney's world. And these firms financial investors that say failing businesses or financial predators that bankrupt otherwise healthy companies and destroy jobs? That's the question. The Center for Economic and Policy Research's Eileen Applebaum and Rosemary Batt explore this approach in their new book, Private Equity at Work When Wall Street Manages Main Street. And Ms. Applebaum joins us now in studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. It makes a difference to have someone face to face. It's great. So a lot of folks' eyes glaze over when we start using terms like private equity. And it's actually, as the more I got into it, I wasn't exactly sure about the term. It's kind of a deceptive term because it really isn't about equity. It's about debt.
Yeah.
I mean, like the veils start right at the get-go. So, but in certain ways, it's similar to buying a house, if I'm not mistaken, but only different.
Yes.
Maybe one just for our lay audience out there, so we don't snow them over. Explain your understanding of private equity,
and
maybe perhaps in terms of homeownership.
I'll start with the use of debt. So we all know that everybody has heard probably that private equity uses a lot of debt. What's probably not clear is that they load this debt onto the company that they're buying. It's as if you bought your neighbor's house, you own the house, they still have to pay the mortgage. It's a strange arrangement where you can mortgage the property of the company that you're buying. They have to pay the debt. The private equity firm has no responsibility for that whatsoever. But the private equity firm still owns the company. So the thing about debt is that it magnifies returns. Just think, I'm going to take a simple example. If you bought a house for $100,000 and you put $20,000 down, and a year later, the house has gone up in price to $110,000. Well, the house has gone up by 10%, but you only put $20,000 down, and now you've gotten an extra $10,000 back. That's a 50% return because of that use of debt. If you had put only $10,000 down and gotten the $10,000 back, that would have been 100% return. So the less money you put in and the more debt you put on the house, the higher is the return to you if that house goes up in value.
Mm-hmm. But you would have to liquidate in order to realize
you'd,
that.
You'd have to sell it.
You'd have to sell it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Which doesn't necessarily happen, right?
Well, the bankruptcy rate in private equity is twice the rate of other companies, publicly traded companies, because of all of this debt. But in the days before the great crisis that we just had, this financial crisis, even though it was twice as high from the point of view of the private equity firms, just the cost of doing business, it wasn't all that high from their perspective. The greater risk they thought was worth the return. And of course, they never bore any of the costs of it. The bankruptcy falls on the company, it falls on the workers, it falls on the creditors, it falls on everybody except for the private equity firm. But when we hit the financial crisis, then something different happened. And all of those highly leveraged, they call it leverage when you use high levels of debt and you use junk bonds, these highly leveraged
companies. Why is the term leverage used in that context?
That's a good question.
Okay.
I think it gives you a lot of leverage over
okay.
the company. But this
all
really
right.
high debt and the use of junk bonds, all leverage is debt, but it's this very risky kind of debt. And what happened in the first 2 years of the financial crisis is that a quarter of highly leveraged companies went bankrupt. Now, 25% of companies going bankrupt, that's a huge number.
Mm-hmm. But the problem is that it doesn't come on the shoulders, it doesn't weigh down the shoulders of the, not so much the investors in the private equity firm, but in the founders, the actual holders of the private equity firm, right?
No, it doesn't weigh on anybody. When a company goes bankrupt, the debt doesn't weigh on anybody.
Well, it weighs on the
workers, it weighs on the company. And when they buy a company and they put 70% debt on that company, which, just as a point of reference, publicly traded companies typically have 30% debt, 70% equity. Private equity-owned companies typically have 70% debt, 30% equity. 70% debt is a lot of debt. And when they put that debt on the company, they're putting creditors at risk. They're putting vendors at risk, the suppliers to the company, all of the stakeholders. And if the company goes bankrupt and has to be liquidated, which happened to a very important retail chain out in California.
What was it called?
Mervyn's. Uh-huh. Mervyn's retail chain, mm-hmm, out in Northern California. When it went bankrupt, it decimated communities, because its stores were the anchor stores in local towns and local malls. And when that store went under, business fell for everybody.
Right. But it doesn't fall for the holders of the private equity firm itself.
That's correct. It does not hold.
I mean, where was, like for Mervyn's, where was the private equity firm?
Well, it was a consortium, but it was led by Sun Capital. And so that's an interesting story, because the company goes bankrupt. They put all this debt on it. They take out, they sell off the assets. They sell off the real estate to pay off the debt. But now the stores still have to pay rent. The thing about retail is that they own their own stores so that they can get through a downturn. You don't have to pay rent, and you can somehow muddle through. But if you have to pay rent, then you're not going to make it. And that's what happened to this, to the Mervyn's chain. Its assets were stripped. It had to pay rent. It couldn't meet the rent payments. It went bankrupt. It had to be liquidated. Private equity made a lot of money. The private equity funds involved in it made a lot of money on this deal. The workers who were laid off, 30,000 workers lost their jobs. We're not talking little. 30,000 workers lost their jobs over the period of time that this company was in private equity hands. The workers had no standing. There was nothing they could do about it. But the vendors, Levi Strauss, for example, they stiffed the vendors. So the vendors got themselves organized. They sued the company. Behind the company is Sun Capital. There was the largest settlement with the vendors that any lawyer has gotten in a private equity case. It was $400 million, and that was only about a third of what Sun Capital had made on the deal. So, mm-hmm, okay, they paid a big fine, so to speak. That wasn't really a fine. The money went back to the vendors. Mm-hmm. The vendors are more or less made whole. The workers never get back to where they were.
What about the investors? Because we want to distinguish between investors and the PE firm itself.
Right? Not really. So here's how it works. You have a PE firm. It has a set of partners. It then recruits investors. The investors put up the money, which is the equity in the private equity fund. They're called limited partners. It's mainly pension funds that put up a third, right, of that money. So you have this money in the private equity fund put up by the investors, and then you have the general partner who is part of the private equity firm. They put in $1 to $2 for every $100 that the other investors put in. So they have very little money in there to begin with. And that is the private equity fund. These are the investors. And the private equity firm does the very best in all of this. If we have time, I'll explain why. But the investors, they're part of the private equity fund. They get money back. They made money on the Mervyn's deal.
All right. But in other situations, the investors might not do so well, right?
It's rare that they do relatively well. Well, here's the thing. They do well in the sense that the company goes bankrupt and they still can make money. But here is the problem, and that is that private equity advertises that it gets better returns for you than in the stock market. That's why the pension funds invest in it. And since 2005, that has not been true. Private equity has not beaten the stock market since 2005. So your pension fund, if you have one, a pension, would be much better off investing in the public equities in the stock market than investing with private equity, where they have to pay all these high fees. That's why the private equity firm does better than anybody. They collect fees from the investors. They collect fees from the portfolio companies. So no matter what happens, as I like to say, the house always wins. You know, they, mm-hmm, make money no matter what happens. Mm-hmm. And in general, the private equity funds, there are some zombie funds where the investors are never going to make any money at all. But by and large, they make money, but they don't make enough to warrant the risk that they're taking, the illiquidity. They tie their money up for 10 years. They're in these risky investments. CalSTRS is invested in a private equity fund, Cerberus, that owns the company that made the guns that killed those little kids in Newtown. And this is the California teachers. They want to get out of that. They don't want to own that company anymore. But hey, Cerberus doesn't want to sell it, and they have no control over what that money is invested in for the 10 years that they've committed.
California teachers.
No investor in a private equity fund has any control over what they invest in, how much debt they put on the company, how many facilities they close, how many workers they lay off. You're the investor, but you have no say. And in the end, you don't beat the market. You don't make out better by getting into these alternatives.
Okay, so you're talking about the California Teachers Union?
Yes, their pension fund.
Some other examples of pension funds that people might
know. Oh, my God, they're all over. So my husband's pension is in what's called PESERS, the Pennsylvania State Employment Educators. He was a high school teacher in Pennsylvania. And I'm just watching as they put more and more money into venture capital and private equity, which is makes us a little bit nervous. But Ohio has money, New Hampshire, New York. It's all over the country that the pension, public pension funds are a major source. 25% of the investment funds that come into private equity come from public employees' pension funds.
Mm-hmm. And this is the world of Mitt Romney, as I said. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was a campaign issue in 2012, and he's back at it again, right?
Yes, he is.
Not at Bain Capital, but some private equity.
Yeah, his son. He's involved with something with his son now. Bain Capital has the examples that Romney liked to give were the examples that came from the days when Bain Capital was in venture capital. Venture capital, you do put up equity because you have little companies that are just starting out. There's nothing to mortgage. So, in fact, you do put up equity, and you do hope they grow. You make your money by growing startup companies. Very different than private equity, which buys mature companies, sometimes does good by them. In the book, we have the examples that we have that show the good things they can do, but mostly it's financial engineering, does not work out well for the companies that they buy.
Uh-huh. In the short time we have left, talk about what, if anything, is being done in terms of regulation.
This is amazing. So Dodd-Frank actually said for the very first time.
No, tell folks what Dodd-Frank.
Okay, so there was no regulation of private equity whatsoever up until 2010. And we passed in this country a financial reform bill, Chris Dodd and Barney Frank, so it's called Dodd-Frank. It required the private equity firms to register and the Securities and Exchange Commission to look at them. And amazingly, they did look at them, and they have found all kinds of terrible things, all kinds of ways that the private equity firms are cheating the unions and other investors in their funds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, prospects for the future, what do you think?
Well, I think that I know what I hope will happen. There are a couple of things that you probably have already heard, that the guys who run these private equity firms make all this money, and they get to their tax at what's called the capital gains rate. But I'd like to fix that tax loophole. And the other thing, we've seen how debt really drives this model in the wrong direction. We need to limit the amount of debt they can put on companies.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's possible in this? Congress is,
well,
we all know, completely deadlocked.
These are regulatory issues. They don't necessarily need Congress to act. Well, the tax one needs Congress to act. But the limiting debt, it turns out that the regulators of banks have written rules that prevent banks that are covered by the FDIC to allow more than 6 times earnings in the debt that's placed on a company. And so this has crimped private equity style a little bit. They have to go into the shadow banking system now. They can't get the big leverage loans anymore from the banks that are regulated. But that was the regulators imposed that limit on the banks they regulate. The SEC can do the same with respect to private equity if it decides it wants to.
Uh-huh. You think it's going to want to?
I'm doing my best. Those of us who are concerned about this have been meeting with people at the SEC and talking to them first about just enforcement. They found all of this criminal behavior. Let's do something about that, and then let's move on to the other issues.
Right. And you've got a An event coming up next week at Busboys and Poets.
Yes, a week from tomorrow, Wednesday night, we'll be at Busboys and Poets from 6:30 to 8. Rose and I will both be there talking about the book and telling, we tell a lot of stories. It sounds like this is going to be a terrible thing to have to listen to, but actually we illustrate the things that private equity is doing by telling you the stories of real companies and real people.
Right, because we certainly are talking about real people. We're talking about 8 million employees involved in holdings held by private equity firms.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's an enormous issue of enormous importance. So where can folks get more information about your particular work at the center's website?
Yes, just on our website, www.ceper.net. And we have a page on private equity issues. You can just Google my name, Eileen Applebaum, A-P-P-E before the L, B-A-U-M.
Right. No relation to the string pedagogue. I don't know.
No.
Okay. And that's, if you don't have a pen to take down the website, it's the Center for Economic
and
Policy Research. If you Google it, you'll find it. And I've been speaking with Eileen Applebaum from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you very much for coming in, and I encourage folks to check out their event at Busboys and Poets, and it's the one at 14th and V,
and
it's going to be a symposium of sorts chaired by William Grider. Right?
So Bill Grider will moderate. I'm sure he'll have some interesting comments.
Wonderful.
And Rose and I have a short presentation. We will love to take your questions.
Great. Check it out. Eileen Applebaum, thanks for coming in. Really
Thank
appreciate
you very
it.
Much. I enjoyed
okay.
being here.
And coming up, a wonderful gypsy swing band invades Capitol Hill this weekend. Don't go away.
Walking with a pack on his back. He had clear blue eyes, and with a little bit of dough, there wasn't much that he doesn't lack. Where's the money? Show me the money.
And we're back with you here on Community Watch and Comment. I'm Dave Rabin, and you've been hearing the music of the Harmonious Whale, and that's W-A-I-L. A band out of Madison, Wisconsin, that's making an appearance this Saturday night at the Corner Store on Capitol Hill. And joining us now by phone from Mad City, Wisconsin, is the Harmonious Whale, Sims Delaney Pothall. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, David. Hey, DC.
Hey.
And hey, I know if I were in town on Wednesday, I'd go down to, what is it, Busboys?
Busboys and Poets. It's based on Langston Hughes's idea. He was a busboy.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day.
Yeah. Well, this CETR.net folks, they're just doing the job. That's great.
Yeah, CEPR.net. Thank you for that comment. And so you're a gypsy swing band. For folks that might not quite realize what that is, how do you describe that?
Well, we don't.
right.
We don't really just, play
you'd music. Rather be a man of mystery, a band of
yeah,
mystery.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, we have chosen Django Reinhardt, D-J-A-N-G-O, is a guitarist who died in 1954, lived in Paris, and kind of single-handedly started this genre of music referred to as gypsy jazz. And I was just so enthralled with it that we kind of took that as our approach to music. And what's happened over the last 27 years is we find, to steal a line from Mickey Hart of the Dead, that we aren't so much musicians as we are travel agents.
Okay.
And we're using this music to move us and to be moved through the music into a better spot. Honesty and truth and, you know, everything that the CETR.net folks believe in and here the Center for Media and Democracy and just all this, you know, now, if not now, well, we need it now more than ever, you know,
right.
Honesty and truthfulness. And you can't lie when you're playing this kind of music, and it's just a moving experience. So we're using the music. It's a trio. I play mandolin, guitar, tenor guitar, and ukulele, and Maggie plays percussion on a cardboard box, and she sings, maybe the world's best singer ever.
I think that might be correct.
Ever. And Jeff Weiss is our bass player. He plays five-string electric and upright bass.
And he, I come from a bass orientation. I'm a cellist, and mm-hmm. he is a wonderful musician.
Yeah, he's a phenom. He's something else. And the nice thing about Jeff, he's only been in the band 4 or 5 years or so, but we get it that this isn't about us, and it's not about grandstanding or egos or look at how good I am. It's about us connecting to the source and letting it move us. So we let the music play us, and that's what we're bringing to an audience.
Check it out this weekend. We're going to have to end it there. Check it out this weekend, The Harmonious Whale at the wonderful Corner Store. You can Google that. It's cornerstorearts.org. It's a wonderful, tremendous venue. You can check out, hear more music on the Harmonious Whale website, whale.com. And the Whale Sims, Delaney Potthoff, thank you very much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, man. We'll see you, right? You'll be there.
Indeed. And many, many thanks to Mike Masella for his help with the show. Coming up, the headlines with Askia Muhammad. And then don't forget the blues. Have a good Veterans Day and a good week. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Rabin.
Driving just as fast as they can drive, trying to squeeze it all into their busy little lives. Orchestrate an exodus from its bump and grind. Everybody's looking for a little peace of mind. Give you everything I got for a little peace of mind. Fireworking of everything. If I'm the lucky one, or if my luck goes down the drain, chances slim to none. The further fast I pedal,
Greetings, I'm Maimuna Youssef, and this is WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.